there shall be no blemish therein. Blind or broken or maimed, or having a wen, or scurvy, or scabbed, ye shall not offer these unto the Lord, nor make an offering by fire of them upon the altar unto the Lord. Either a bullock or a lamb that hath anything superfluous or lacking in his parts, that mayest thou offer for a free will offering, but for a vow it shall not be accepted. Ye shall not offer unto the Lord that which is bruised or crushed or broken or cut, neither shall ye make any offering thereof in your land. Neither from a stranger's hand shall ye offer the bread of your God of any of these, because their corruption is in them, and blemishes be in them. They shall not be accepted for you. Leviticus 22:19-25. Harmony with the cosmic order cannot be established by foisting off on the divine something that is damaged and useless for current purpose, and therefore all too conveniently and hypocritically offered as an indication of aim, purpose, and intent. This is a variant of the vain using of God's name, which becomes something strictly forbidden in commandments handed down to Moses in the Exodus text. Everything possible must be directed upward to the highest possible aim, for the unself-conscious walking with God that characterizes Abel's mode of being to become possible. The idea that such offering must be of the highest quality is already implicitly axiomatic at the time when the Cain and Abel story emerges, although the story represents that understanding and furthers it. Only God knows, so to speak, how much intense striving for clear conceptualization preceded that stunningly clear, distilled, and unforgettable formulation. Cain also offers not the heavenly fruit or the highest aspirations of the Spirit, but the fruit of the ground, Genesis 4:4. Abel, by contrast, offers not only the perfect firstborn, but the fat thereof, also Genesis 4:4. The most fruitful or richest part, representing the peak, best, or finest of something. The cooking and burning of animal fat during sacrifices was also held to release an aroma that God experienced according to various descriptions, Leviticus 3:16, as sweet savor, King James Version, refreshing, literal standard version, pleasing, New International Version, and perhaps most interesting, given the serious advantages of not irritating the very agent of divine justice, soothing, Amplified Bible. And the priest shall burn them upon the altar. It is the food of the offering made by fire for a sweet savor. All the fat is the Lord's. The best part is by necessity, God's. This is a matter of definition, as much as practical sense and theological, spiritual, or psychological realization. Of course, what is most likely to work is the wholehearted offering of what is best. Of course, what is best should be devoted to the highest imaginable purpose. Anything else is not aiming at success, at life more abundant, at reestablishment of the Garden of Eden. Anything else is aiming at failure, the dull misery of mediocrity, or the unbearable suffering of the abysmal itself. Abel is a shepherd, and we have already indicated why. He offers the lambs he raises to God, offers in good faith the best cuts butchered from the most perfect animals, abiding by the doctrine later delineated in Leviticus and elsewhere. Cain makes sacrifices too. He is a farmer. He offers the plants he grows to God. And Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord. And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering. Genesis 4:2-4. Alternative translations for the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof, varying the theme of highest quality, the best portions of the firstborn lambs from his flock, New International Version, the finest firstborn of his flock and the fat portions, Amplified Bible, the firstborn lamb from his sheep and the Lord the best parts of it, Contemporary English Version, and some choice parts of the firstborn animals from his flock, God's Word Translation. Let us reiterate, among the people who wrote these lines, the firstborn of an animal, or indeed a human being, had special status, was implicitly or even explicitly consecrated to God, so that the choicest cut from a firstborn lamb was indeed the best of the best. Cain, however, does not do so well in his offerings, to say the least. 3.6, creatively possessed by the spirit of resentment. God's respect for Abel's offerings is not echoed in the case of his brother. Why? Cain appears to be keeping something in reserve, holding something back, failing to put his best foot forward. His offerings are first damned by faint praise. Abel's offerings are defined explicitly in the text as of the highest quality, while little is said about what Cain brings to the table. Further, and more definitively, Cain is directly upbraided by God for his half-hearted and deceitful efforts. If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted. And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door. Genesis 4:7. Alternative translations include, if you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it. New International Version. If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is contrary to you, but you must rule over it. English Standard Version. If you do well, won't you be accepted? But if you don't do well, sin is lying outside your door, ready to attack. It wants to control you, but you must master it. God's Word Translation. If you had done the right thing, you would be smiling. But because you have done evil, sin is crouching at your door. It wants to rule you, but you must overcome it. Good News Translation. This idea of encroaching sin makes itself manifest again in varied form and much later in the biblical texts in 1 Peter 5:8. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about, seeking whom he may devour. It is useful to outline Cain's situation to understand what is meant by the fact of this devil at the door. Abel's wayward brother is unhappy, of fallen countenance, in the aftermath of his failure. He takes it up with God. God informs him that he would be successful if only he did well, that is, make the exceptional offering that life truly demands. God then explains Cain's predicament in a more sophisticated and also much more cutting, burning, and damning manner. It is not exactly that failure, per se, has produced the misery of the would-be successful plaintiff. The divine indicates that it is instead his response to failure. Instead of noting his error, rectifying his ways, and improving the quality of his sacrifices, instead of confessing, repenting, and atoning, it might be said, Cain instead opens the door to something that both justifies and amplifies his rebellion and resentment. A very deep causal analysis is transpiring in a few short lines in relationship to the existence and effect and voluntary invitational relationship with the sin that lies or crouches at the door. This can be profitably explored in two manners. First, in the tradition of biblical exegesis itself. Second, in explicating the parallel between this story and certain obscure variations of the story of the Egyptian redeemer god Horus's battle with Seth. Seth was the Egyptian version of Satan, the eternal destroyer of tradition and of the vision that redeems and resurrects. Note first the consequence of Cain's failure to do well, of his rejection of the opportunity to go all in or to fully commit, of his failure to offer his best. God smiles, so to speak, upon Abel and his sacrifice. But unto Cain and his offering he had not respect. Genesis 4:5. Cain's response? And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. Genesis 4:5, King James Version. Other translations amplify the nature of this response. Cain is angry and downcast, New International Version. Dejected, New Living Translation. Indignant, annoyed, and hostile, Amplified Bible. Furious and despondent, Holman Christian Standard Bible. Sorrowful, Brenton Septuagint Translation. Unable to hide his feelings, Contemporary English Version. And prone to scowl, Good News Translation. And upset and depressed, International Standard Version. The Scottish preacher and writer Alexander McLaren, 1910, well known at the time and after for his biblical expositions, had the following to say about this passage. Strange as the words sound, if I mistake not, they convey some very solemn lessons, and if well considered, become pregnant with meaning. The key to the whole interpretation of them is to remember that they describe what happens after and because of wrongdoing. They are all suspended on, if thou doest not well. Then, in that case, for the first thing, sin lieth at the door. Now the word translated here, lieth, is employed only to express the crouching of an animal, and frequently of a wild animal. The picture then is of the wrongdoer's sin lying at his door, there like a crouching tiger, ready to spring. And if it springs, fatal. If thou doest not well, a wild beast crouches at thy door. Then there follow, with a singular swift transition of the metaphor, other words still harder to interpret, and which have been, as a matter of fact, interpreted in very diverse fashions. And unto thee shall be its desire, and thou shalt rule over it. Where did we hear these words before? They were spoken to Eve in the declaration of her punishment. They contain the blessing that was embedded in the curse. Thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. The longing of the pure womanly heart to the husband of her love, and the authority of the husband over the loving wife, the source of the deepest joy and purity of earth, is transferred by a singularly bold metaphor to this other relationship. And in horrible parody of the wedded union and love, we have the picture of the sin that was thought of as crouching at the sinner's door like a wild beast, now, as it were, wedded to him. He is mated to it now, and it has a kind of tigerish, murderous desire after him, while he on his part is to subdue and control it. Alexander McLean. There is a very interesting parallel between this story and an account in the ancient Egyptian texts detailing the relationship of the primary gods and goddess of that state, who were Osiris, Seth, Isis, and Horus. Horus and Seth are contending gods whose battle is very much reminiscent of the opposition between Abel and Cain, respectively. The former is the Egyptian god of careful attention and renewal. The latter, the eternal plotter and power-mad social climber. Horace returns from a youth and adolescence spent in exile to confront Seth, who is his evil uncle, after the latter has overthrown his father and usurped the throne, much like King Arthur or Simba in Disney's The Lion King. They battle terribly for dominance, or in the case of the hero, authority. Some variants have Horace losing an eye in the confrontation with Seth. This is an indication of the danger posed by the fact of a transcendent and ultimate malevolence to consciousness itself. Others, for example, the contendings of Horace, stress that a sexual relationship is forced upon Horace by Seth, successfully, in part, or unsuccessfully, depending on the text, akin to that which apparently transpires between Cain and Sin. While the two wrestle, Seth attempts to sexually abuse Horace. In some versions, Seth's seed enters the body of Horace and makes him ill. This is very much reminiscent of the idea of the Horcrux developed by author J.K. Rowling, the intrusion of something living, something seed-like, into the soul itself. In other versions, including the contendings text itself, Horace thwarts Seth by catching the seed in his hands, whereupon his mother, Isis, reverses the game, offering Horace's seed to Seth in secret and defeating him in consequence. The meaning of this should be made clear. The corrupting influence of Seth is his seminal idea, while the redeeming influence of Horace is his. The former can terribly threaten the latter, but the latter can triumph as well and continually over the former. The sexual metaphor is apt as well as frightening, because the voluntary union of Cain with sin has a creative element. We understand this at some implicit level, not least because our curses, when we curse dreadful fate, reflect such understanding or mirror that complex of meaning. We describe ourselves as being fucked with when manipulated or deceived, as being fucked over when something has not gone our way, of things being all fucked up when they are not laying themselves out as we would like, and most likely because our sacrifices have been truly second rate. There is a real bitterness in such complaints when they are not made in a humorous manner, a bitterness that is both the claiming of the much vaunted and I can do no wrong status of victim and an accusation that something is flawed at the fundament of the cosmic or even divine order. God takes it upon himself to indicate and insist that Cain's misery is not caused in some simple deterministic manner by the fact of his second-rate work or sacrifice, even though his failure itself is caused by exactly that. There is failure, certainly, but that is held to be something separate from the emotional response to the failure, something separate even from the understanding of its causal consequences. God implies that Cain could react to and interpret his downfall in a manner that differs from the manner he has chosen and is more appropriate, acceptable, and productive. He could, for example, become contrite and strive to improve, even to be grateful for the lesson that failure has brought him. He could engage in the radical acceptance of fault and the consequent, painful retooling of personality. He could subject himself voluntarily to the terrible swift sword and let the dead wood be cut and burned away. Instead, Cain invites in the devil himself. Worse, it is also not merely that Cain allows himself to be possessed, such that he is deprived of his will, or that he blindly follows like a hapless puppet, controlled in a simply deterministic manner. Quite the contrary. As a creature with inviolable free will, he enters instead into a voluntary and blackly creative relationship with the temptation crouching in predatory form at his doorstep. He willingly enables it to have its way with him. Then he broods over what has been so terribly borne. No one moves to murder from mere resentment without a lengthy period of oh so delightfully obsessive dwelling and fantasizing. The perverse relationship Cain develops with sin enables that dread spirit to bloom in all its particulars, enables the more abstract beckoning spirit of evil to manifest itself concretely in the specific time and place of the present, enables the anti-human adversarial spirit to incarnate. The sinner therefore consorts freely and voluntarily, malicia precogitata, malice aforethought, with what might be described as the general spirit of mayhem. By doing so, he takes within himself the leaven of malice and makes it his own. This makes manifest in the world his particularized, embodied, creative destiny of mayhem, justified by his own resentments, jealousies, disappointments, frustrations, rages, and victimizations, often real, as suffering and injustice is often real. Every school shooter, for example, has his now stereotyped manifesto, his false prophecy, his well-developed and long-brooded-upon rationale. The fact that such missives are frequently understandable and even capable of eliciting some recognition and sympathy for what is human, all too human, does not make the associated and well-rationalized crime any less reprehensible. Everyone has sufficient reason for evil. It is this undeniable fact of intermediary collaborative process that makes a mockery of any simple-minded attempts to draw a causal pathway between the tragic circumstances of a given person's life and their consequent descent into evil. This is another variant of brute empiricism and idiot determinism. Hurt people become bad is not a well-developed causal theory. The hypothesis that bad people use the inevitable hurts they have suffered in their lives, many of which they arguably brought upon themselves, to justify their evil is equally plausible. And there is no reason not to assume, at minimum, that it is a little from column A and a little from column B. And a few words might well be said in favor of arguments for the fundamental role for the pathway from manipulative victimhood rather than pain to evil. First, it is obviously the case that someone motivated to do harm will claim every possible self-justification for doing so, and that doing so is an inextricable part or even the main feature of the evil they are aiming at. Second, although the temptation toward, say, resentment might loom large, particularly when a person has been betrayed as well as damaged, the pact with sin simply does not have to be made, let alone encouraged, cultivated, and nurtured. Someone victimized, however unfairly, could well, and should conclude from their experience, not that such hurt should be paid forward or extended in its application even to God himself, but that such acts are wrong, and to reject their furtherance instead of identifying with and mimicking the perpetrator, transmitting childhood abuse down the generations, for example. If this were not true, every family would rapidly become a horror show, as all abuse would be conserved and transmitted and therefore inevitably spread until everyone was contaminated and perpetrating. Most people offered the example of the bully, or worse, will choose not to duplicate, but to reject it, such that its damaging effect is ameliorated across time rather than exaggerated and expanded. The human race would be in a sorry state indeed, and in no time, if this was not the case. Thus, the more accurate model is not evil comes from pain, inequality, betrayal, oppression, even tragedy, But hurt people recover, forgive, and move on. Work as sacrifice in the Cain and Abel narrative is the attempt to act out the essence of work, to understand its central tendency, to portray or conceptualize the nature of the efforts of man. This occurs first in dramatic representation, literal acting out, the equivalent of the pretend play that is so formative among children. Then it is represented in dramatic imagination. Afterward, if possible, it is explicitly formulated as story and description. We are still in the latter stage, despite the intermediating centuries, with regard to our full understanding of sacrifice, as the process of coming to full explicit consciousness is a difficult one, with an unknown extent or upper limit. The great Swiss genetic epistemologist and developmental psychologist Jean Piaget noted that children are prone to imitate themselves, that they will note actions they have taken that produce a desired or interestingly unexpected outcome, become conscious of those actions, that is, notice that and how they undertook them, and then copy or mimic themselves, representing the action in reenactment. This is partially the formulation of skill, ability, or habit, if sufficiently repeated, and partially a bridge to understanding, as opposed to simply doing. Early childhood games, such as peekaboo, emerge when an infant and an adult perform such acts of ritualization together, synchronizing their efforts, establishing a game rule-like regularity in iterated action and reaction. Constancy and predictability of fair exchange with optimally interesting variation, the genesis of trade. We trade every time we imitate one another, each time we open our mouths to speak. We offer each other the fruits of our exploratory and conscientious effort and derive immense nourishment in return. This is not just a metaphor. It is one thing to offer someone food, but something else completely to teach them how to provision themselves. Christ is, for example, the miraculous provider of water. John 4:13-14. Loaves and fishes, Matthew 14:15-21. Because he embodies or stands for or represents or is the ethos of complete voluntary self-sacrifice, upon which productive activity in trade itself rests. This might be understood as the full manifestation of the offerings of Abel that, in comparison with Cain's, earned the respect of God, Genesis 4:4. This is a viewpoint that takes into account the reliance of provision, even of so-called natural resources, on an individual and socially instantiated ethos that makes the very use, even the discovery of such resources, possible, productive, and sustainable. The self-mimicry described by Piaget can well be considered the basis of ritual. Imagine, however, that in the case of the imitation that most truly characterizes human play, something somewhat more complex is occurring, something much more sophisticated than the mere mimicry or exact duplication of a single action, something more akin to the mimicry of a set of related actions. In this case, that set of related actions would be various ways and means of giving something up in the present to best ensure, or at least to place a bet on, the future and its potential returns. The consequence of such mimicry is, most concretely, the drama of the sacrificial altar. More abstractly or psychologically, it is the drama of bargaining with possibility, the drama of negotiating with the future or the future self, the drama of establishing a contractual covenant with the very spirit of being. The full manifestation of this drama, would be the personality predicated upon the offering that is the most comprehensive possible or even conceivable. That would be the incarnation of the personality that lights or illuminates the world, Matthew 5, 14 to 15, the very Word made flesh, John 1, 14. The imagery used to define the method of communication with the divine in the ancient story at hand is very concrete and archaic, according to the conventions of modern sensibility, and relies on a series of implicit metaphorical conventions or presumptions. Up is good compared with down. Down is demoralized, hunched, slumped. Down is downcast, with fallen countenance. Down is dirt, dust, contamination, and multiplicity. Up is progress compared with descent, compared with failure. Heaven is good and progress. Heaven is up and the unity of all integrated upward aim. The ultimate up is skyward. Thus, heaven is skyward. God is the ultimate good. The ultimate good, God, therefore must reside in heaven. Smoke rises up. Smoke is essence, gist, or spirit. The entity residing in or characterizing the ultimate up can detect the quality of a sacrifice in the upward rising smoke. Finally, the offering that aims up most successfully is the complete and perfect investment that best pleases God. Because of the concreteness of this archaic content and imagery, it is easy for modern people, and quite the existential relief, to overlook the very brief story's deep sophistication in problem statement, revelation, deliberation, and conclusion. Once the reasons for or logic of the reference is made clearer, however, that casual overlooking is no longer possible. It is following such realization that the real trouble, the real adventure, can begin. Why might heaven be up? Because the sky is beyond us, and therefore representative of what is eternally beyond. Because up is the proper aim, as opposed, metaphorically, to down. Because we look up to people we admire, thus constituting their character as our eventual aim. Because if we look down, we can only see what we are standing on and not where we are going. Because to look down on is to be contemptuous of. Because contemplation of the heavens to which we might raise our eyes inspires awe and the desire to imitate. Because we can come to be what we imitate most devoutly, and because we can, in truth, navigate by the position of the heavenly bodies. As linguist and philosopher George Lakoff notes, up is good is an image schema that is based on the universal human experience of being upright, vertical, and oriented toward the sky. The metaphorical entailments of the image schema are highly systematized and can be observed in a wide variety of domains. It is a pervasive, deep-seated, and highly conventionalized metaphor in our language and thought. We can understand from this why the metaphor of up versus down springs to mind, is available for use, makes sense, and can be communicated. And as well, how that understandable and communicable sense depends on embodiment. An upright man is motivated, optimistic, gazing forward, and moving, in stark contrast with someone defeated, slumped, and looking at the ground. Up is positive emotion and approach. Down is collapsed and avoidant. The meaning of up is therefore not a mere reflection of its relationship to other words, but a reference to a shared category of experience, whose nature is in turn dependent on the shared psychophysiological structures, the embodiment or incarnation, that gives all human experience its particular quality, and that makes it broadly and understandably similar and communicable. Why does God reside in heaven? Because the awe that enters and inspires us when we gaze upward at the sun or moon or the starry realm of the night sky puts us in touch at an instinctual level with the spirit that descended, the same also that ascended up far above all heavens, that he might fill all things, Ephesians 4:10. Why is the God who occupies the highest upward place concerned about the quality of sacrifice? Why exactly is something far from clear, a question whose answer inevitably shades into the ineffable. It is at least in part because all things worth doing either have no relationship with one another or conflict in their realization, or both reflect and are united in some mysterious manner with the transcendent good itself, as those are the only three options. If irrelevant to one another, uniting them within the confines of a single personality or society becomes a difficult endeavor, one that is only exaggerated to the point of impossibility if instead they exist in a difference that is irreconcilable. To what end, then, if any, do and should all things strive? Toward the ultimate up, perhaps? Toward the final good, however that might be described? This appears as the hypothesis or insistence of the monotheism of the biblical stories, and is the alternative, by definition, to dissociation or paradoxical opposition. That is certainly the idea implicit, say, in the imagery of Jacob's ladder, which presents a never-ending spiraling hierarchy of up toward a heaven that is already good, but is still and endlessly getting better. And Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran, and he lighted upon a certain place and tarried there all night, because the sun was set. And he took of the stones of that place and put them for his pillows and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, thy father, and the God of Isaac. Genesis 28:10-13. Consider too, or remember, that any directed attention or action is a unity, however temporary, of many diverse spirits and materials. Even to move my hand to grip a glass to bring it to my mouth requires both sacrifice and singularity of purpose. The former is the prioritization of the demands of thirst over every other current motivating spirit. The latter is the domination of the pattern of attention and action that serves the purposes of the movement in question over all other potential actions. Such a unity is necessarily integrated into a higher unity, or the action is shallow, even pointless. Although there is some immediate pleasure in the consequences of my action, in the refreshment of the drink, I quench my thirst most fundamentally to serve my other purposes. These tend to be arranged upward and hierarchically, insofar as what I am doing most broadly has a point and a purpose. There is no reason to assign an arbitrary ceiling to the fact of that upward striving. To posit that unity exists, say, at the level of the local action, but not at any higher point, or indeed, at the highest of all conceivable points. This is expressed symbolically in an image-laden, dramatic, and literary manner in the idea of a ladder, pole, or tree, bridging the gap between earth and heaven. This is one of the most ancient ideas of mankind, stretching back to Paleolithic times and the shamanic rituals employing the imagery of the cosmic tree. As the great Romanian historian of religion, Mircea Eliade, notes, we find the symbolism of the liana or vine stretching from earth to heaven in the Iranian, Slav, and Finno-Ugrian areas, and the symbolism of the cosmic tree, which is also a liana, in the Iranian, Indo-European, and Altaic areas, as well as in America and among the Oceanic peoples. The tree is often considered to be the ladder that connects the three levels of the cosmos, the underworld, the earth, and the sky. The symbolism of the cosmic tree and the world pillar, the tree of life and the ladder of the gods, is one of the most widespread and deeply rooted in human culture. It is not an exaggeration to say that no other symbol touches the core of the sacred so universally, and none is capable of conveying to any mind, regardless of its cultural background, the same meaning and force. Mircea Eliade. The spirit of being and becoming strives upward toward a continual unfolding of forms. Man is made in the image of that spirit and is called on to sacrifice without reservation in the pursuit of its manifestation. The integrity of the psyche and the stability and productivity of the community are in fact predicated on the willingness to do so. This is by no means some arbitrary supposition. It is instead the deepest possible reflection of the cosmic order, founded on the principle of voluntary offering upward. This is the order that cannot be pridefully rejected by woman or man without the direst of consequences. The order, by definition, that the Luciferian spirit opposes and attempts to usurp, by definition. Some sacrifices work, are accepted, while others clearly do not and are rejected. This is one of the inalienable facts of life. It is the reason both for much celebrating and rejoicing and for an endless, abysmal bitterness. If this is the fundamental fact, then the fundamental question of being, the fundamental moral rather than factual question, might well be, what or how should you offer or sacrifice to God to solve the problem of what is acceptable to God, the problem of what is likely to be successful in the highest of possible senses? The answer proffered by the ancient authors? The best you have, or heaven help you. Or, even more starkly, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. Gospel of Thomas, saying 70. It is in establishing this relationship between talent, opportunity, and responsibility that God ensures the maintenance of the eternal balance of justice. This is the meaning of the analogous warning. For unto whomsoever much is given, of him shall be much required. Luke 12:48. The level of sacrifice demanded by the divine is proportionate to the degree of privilege awarded, however apparently arbitrarily, to the fortunate or withheld from the lowly. Cain's great and archetypal sin is therefore best understood as his holding back, his hiding of his God-given light under a bushel, his putting it in a secret place, Luke 11:33, his failing to offer his best. This is not good, as far as God is concerned, not acceptable to God. but it is also neither acceptable to nor good for Cain, or as it turns out, for Abel, for God, for the descendants of Cain, or for the whole human race, insofar as those who compose it are tempted by the same spirit that beckoned at the murderous brother's door. Cain burns angrily, not only because he has withheld his best and angered the divine, but because he thereby forgoes what is best in his life in so doing. The sacrificial ritual, a burnt offering in this case, is the attempt to signal evidence about quality of offering and, at a deeper level, intent, up the hierarchy of value, the cosmic tree, so to speak, to the highest possible heavenly place. This enables establishment of the proper relationship with what is highest. Cain's failure to do this properly means that he deprives himself of what could be the true romantic adventure of his life, the adventure that might justify that very life and provide it with the significance that is the most effective antidote to nihilistic bitterness and resentful rebellion. It is by no means only the lack of the external social trappings of success, which are not forthcoming because of his lack of true effort, that embitters Abel's hostile brother. It is the absence of meaning in his life, attendant upon his arrogant, deceitful, and slothful withholding. What then is the moral of the story? What is its point or aim? The insistence that life more abundant requires a complete and total commitment with every glance, with every word, with every action. We are called upon, in the face of life's overwhelming difficulties and opportunities, to offer no less than absolutely everything we have, everything, conceptualized more appropriately, that we have been given and should be grateful for, rather than, say, proud of. Cain and Abel play out this pattern in the concrete manner of material offering. Later in the biblical accounts, and in the depths of the increasingly sophisticated and self-reflective soul, the essence of a sacrifice becomes its intent rather than its concrete reality, becomes the psychological offering or aim rather than the material thing given up. But the seeds for this more sophisticated understanding are already sown in the story of Cain and Abel. Aim up and offer all that you have. 3.7. Humility and faith versus pride, despair, and vengeful anger. What does it mean to do well or to not do well, to succeed or to fail? The people who formulated and retold the biblical stories in the attempt to answer those perennial existential questions were just as intelligent and wise as we are today, perhaps more so, given the extreme difficulty of their existence and the moral demands that difficulty placed upon them. They were trying to understand something, to prioritize their attention in accordance with that understanding, and to aim properly in consequence. They were trying to determine how to comport themselves so that they could bargain, formulate a contract, agreement, or covenant with the central spirit of being itself, and to do so victoriously. They were as well trying to formulate a picture of the deviant path away from victory and toward failure for the purposes of contrast, so that consort with the spirit that tempts along that path could be avoided. Everyone always has and always will need and want to understand how to manage exactly that, to select and traverse the right path forward and to avoid the worst detours and pitfalls. That is precisely the guidance provided by calling and conscience, which are the primary twin messengers of God. This can be most prosaically and reductively understood as the attempt to balance the requirements, the needs and wants, of the present, which appear as immediate desire, with the more abstracted but also vital reality of the future. This means, do not do anything today in the grip of your impulse that will compromise tomorrow, or next week, month, or year. Alternatively, although there is in fact no difference between the two, do not compromise your social relations, given how badly you are outnumbered, by prioritizing the necessities of the moment. Such reductionism leads to an incomplete and oversimplified understanding of such balance, however. The covenant is not merely the bargain between present and future and individual and community, but a contract ensuring a relationship between individual and community and the spirit of individual and community. That spirit has so far in the story been conceptualized as the process that establishes order in its contending with possibility. The Heavenly Father that, or who, establishes the moral order, forbids its alteration, and punishes deviation from the straight and narrow path, the proper target of sacrifice, and the judge of its quality. This is not merely the order itself, God the Father, it might be said, although it is also that. It is as well the pattern of active confrontation with the unknown that even the Father depends upon and, in some sense, is. These are not calls to a childish superstition. They are instead definitions, characterizations of the spirit of the ultimate up. They are definitions of God. They are attempts to establish the axiom of ultimate unity as the foundation of the real, as what eternally keeps dread, pain, and death at bay, gives meaning and purpose, and inspires hope. Abel's sacrifices are met with praise, while Cain's are not. Cain gets nowhere in his life, not because God or the world is arbitrary, but because his sacrifices are insufficient. This is an insistence that echoes the divine prohibition against consuming the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, the insistence that there is an implicit moral order, the suffusing of the whole of the being and becoming with the creative spirit that is its originator and continuer. It is not up to man or woman to usurp the right to create that moral order or to attempt to circumvent its strictures pridefully or in a Machiavellian or otherwise manipulative and false manner. Instead, we are built, so to speak, to honor and reflect that order, to adapt to it, to interpret signs of failure, not as insufficiency on the part of the cosmos and its creator, but as evidence of personal insufficiency, to strive such that only what is best is offered, and, if that is not good enough, to search for something better yet. Cain rejects all of that personal responsibility, attempting instead to shape the entire world in the image of his inadequacy. When this fails, as it must, he invites the spirit of bitterness to dwell within him instead of setting his house in order. In doing so, he rejects even the advice of God, who, when he calls upon him, states in no uncertain terms, quite the contrary, that his wayward son would yet be accepted if he did well, and that his bitterness and resentment is a consequence of his voluntary dalliance with sin. Rather than changing, therefore, as God suggests, a very early manifestation of the idea of an inner voice of conscience, Cain kills his brother and in doing so, turns against being and becoming itself, deeper yet, against God himself as the creator of that being, instead of making his bed gratefully, Cain becomes murderous and more deicidal. He kills Abel, of course, but he does so in the final analysis to obtain vengeance against God. This is the true description of the deepest possible bitterness and hatred. The bitter man with fallen countenance does so in the same spirit that possesses Adam when he so resentfully charges woman and God with the responsibility for his own fall and consequent cowardly hiding. In the same spirit that Job's wife calls upon her suffering husband to adopt when he is brought low by the machinations of Satan and loses everything, wealth, health, dignity, and companionship. Curse God and die, she says, Job 2:9. And even compassionately, perhaps, observing as she does her husband's utter and apparently undeserved misery. The Abel whose success burns so deeply is, after all, God's favored son. His murder is therefore the ultimate revenge against that hypothetically unfairly favoring father. It does not take a particularly perspicacious reader to see in that murder not only of the innocent but the positively good, the precursor to the fate of Christ. Cain is tempted by the spirit of sin itself, just as his parents were in the Garden of Eden, although in somewhat variant form. He embraces that tempter with open arms, and then works diligently with that dread essence to create a vengeance as terrible as he could imagine. In this light, it is worthwhile to consider this stark fact. There is no shortage of modern atheists who, despite their disbelief, remain perfectly willing, like Cain and unlike Abel and Job, to shake their fist at God. They may claim to be doing so on behalf of the victims of the world, themselves included. They may even believe that this is the case, even though someone truly perspicacious and discerning would be very skeptical about the validity of such an attribution. There nonetheless lurks a terrible unconscious darkness in such a claim. The great Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky's murderous Raskolnikov, protagonist of Crime and Punishment, that stellar masterpiece, certainly imagines himself as heroic savior to the oppressed and poor, as well as daring transgressor of even the most fundamental norms and ideals of the world. It does not take much introspection, particularly in relation to bitterness, to understand Cain. There is not a man or woman alive who has not been racked at some point with envy, resentful at failure, wishing harm to the comparatively successful, the terribly ideal. It is very difficult not to curse God, so to speak, when everything is falling apart around you, particularly when the justice of that disintegration appears questionable, as it so often does. Cain fails. Then he renders himself self-righteously cynical and bitter enough to take up the issue with God himself. This is, to put it mildly, a preposterous thing to do, a true sin of arrogance, resentment, and deceit. God, whatever or whoever he might be, is, by definition, beyond the scope of human judgment, as he reminds Job much later in the biblical corpus. Canst thou draw out Leviathan with an hook, or his tongue with a cord which thou lettest down? Canst thou put an hook into his nose, or bore his jaw through with a thorn? Will he make many supplications unto thee? Will he speak soft words unto thee? Will he make a covenant with thee? Wilt thou take him for a servant forever? Wilt thou play with him as with a bird, or wilt thou bind him for thy maidens? Shall the companions make a banquet of him? Shall they part him among the merchants? Canst thou fill his skin with barbed irons, or his head with fish spears? Lay thine hand upon him. Remember the battle. Do no more. Behold, the hope of him is in vain. Shall not one be cast down even at the sight of him? None is so fierce that dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand before me? Job 41:1-10. He beholdeth all high things. He is a king over all the children of pride. Job 41:34. God is he who eternally defeats even the monstrous Leviathan itself, confronting and overcoming chaos, underworld, and the possibility signified not least by the terrible dragon, source of the greatest treasures of the world. He cannot therefore be trifled with, no matter the justification. Man is simply in no position to question the fundamental order of reality, not at its deepest levels. To do so is rebellion, and not of the heroic sort, no matter how it is dressed up or justified. To do so is the sin of pride, the insistence that the forbidden fruit is edible and that its incorporation bestows wisdom, the very pride that not only goes before, but is the very essence of the fall. Failure to abide by or mimic the moral order of the creative spirit of being and becoming as if it were good is no different than failure to adapt to the deepest reality, or, more accurately, stubborn, bitter, and prideful refusal to do so, which is the most egregious, deepest, and counterproductive form of failure. That is most truly a failure of the faith on which life itself, let alone life more abundant, eternally and necessarily depends. It is therefore the deepest of moral requirements to hold life and God to be good, no matter what. No matter what. This is a terrible truth. There are no circumstances under which failure to do so can be redefined as success, even when, as in the latter case, both of the long-suffering Job and of Christ himself, the decision even to discontinue living or to lash out in homicidal or even genocidal anger could be understandable to the compassionate and all-too-human onlooker. It is much better, even under conditions of extreme and apparently unjust suffering, to reaffirm our commitment to life more abundant and to undergo the changes necessary to bear our terrible cross. This is a terrible truth, given what human beings are inevitably called on to bear. The ultimate promise of the covenant, however, is that the Spirit of God, reflected in such radical acceptance, abides with us in our suffering and confrontation with evil. And what can withstand the man who has God truly on his side? Unlike Cain, Job has the sense to hold his tongue in the face of God's reminder of his ineffable mystery and omniscient, omnipresent, and omnipotent sovereignty. The latter realizes, properly and pragmatically, given that stubbornness and bitterness do nothing but make suffering worse, that he is in no position as a mortal creature to render judgment about the propriety not only of being, but of the very creator or precondition of that being. In his misery, Job therefore responds to God contritely in a manner opposite to that of Cain. I know that thou canst do everything, and that no thought can be withholden from thee. Who is he that hideth counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that I understood not things too wonderful for me, which I knew not. Hear, I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself, and repent in dust and ashes. Job 42:2-6. Even though the nature of Job's sins, such as they might be, are not evident to him, even though he may even well be, in some fundamental sense, innocent, he does not fall prey to the temptation of pride. Instead, he searches his conscience for his own flaws and repents as completely as is possible. C.G. Jung famously and controversially suggested that this decision put Job in a position of moral superiority to God himself, as Yahweh put Job to the ultimate test, visiting upon him tragedy after tragedy at the instigation of none other than Satan, his most wayward and incomprehensible son, and that it was this imbalance in moral order that instigated the passion. There is, after all, no indication in the text that Job, unlike Cain, has done anything to deserve his terrible fate. Quite the contrary, as Job's goodness is testified to by God himself. Job 8. God, nonetheless, puts his faithful son, so to speak, to a severe test, handing him over to Satan to torture, wagering with the devil that Job will not lose faith. This is a decision that at least seems profoundly unfair, to say the least. How then is this terrible story to be understood, existentially, if not theologically? First, it is clearly the case that the innocent suffer, and often worse than the guilty, who are at least relieved in the deepest sense by the fact of their punishment, as Dostoevsky was at pains to establish in the case of Raskolnikov, once again in Crime and Punishment. The fact of this undeserved suffering is one of the existential truths that makes life itself appear, if not utterly unbearable, then at least unjustifiable. Its reality is so profound that it is a central theme of Christ's incarnation. Second, it is the case, at least arguably, that the God within can be called on to defend against the God without, so to speak, against the vagaries of fate. All the horrors of life, destruction of family, disease, disfigurement, and unwarranted social accusation and judgment come raining down on Job, who refuses, despite it all, to lose faith and to succumb to, deli with more accurately, bitterness, resentment, and nihilism. He rejects the root of Cain, maintaining his faith in himself, life, and God, and is rewarded in the final analysis with the provision of something more complete and of higher quality than all that he has lost. Finally, perhaps, Job has faith in himself and in God, but God also has faith in Job and in man in general. He is the fatherly spirit who insists that we can triumph against adversity, no matter how profound the challenge. He is, therefore, the spirit of encouragement that makes itself manifest in the advice of our fathers and our more courageous mothers when they say, "Go out into the world with all its challenges and opportunities and prevail. Learn how to handle the serpents instead of hiding or fleeing from them." Why would God throw Job or any of us into the ring, even with the devil himself? Because he is confident in our victory. Who then is God? The spirit within us that is eternally confident in our victory. This is another indication of what is to be properly and necessarily put in the highest place. Another characterization of the ultimate unity. Another definition of God. We are certain to experience encounters of sufficient magnitude and apparent injustice in the course of our lives to make bitterness and cynicism appear little more than the necessary and boon companions of the desire for justice. Who among us has not or will not be tempted to scream in frustration, rage, and despair at the sky, to curse fate itself for the dreadful burden that existence has placed on us, to not only lose faith, but to view that very loss as nothing short of a moral inevitability, even a requirement, reacting as we are to the all too obvious evidence, the terrible facts at hand. But none of that is helpful. All that such bitter, albeit apparently justified and requisite faithlessness does is transform what might otherwise be mere tragedy, mere, into something much more like hell. When we are called upon to suffer injustice and tragedy, is our suffering not inevitably multiplied manifold by acquiescence to the blandishments of anger, envy, resentment, and vengefulness? The serpent that lurks forever in the garden is thus best confronted in a spirit antithetical to that of resentment and arrogant, wounded pride. No matter how much poison it is exuding or has delivered, is that not the best pathway forward in times of true trouble? Hence, the emphasis on humility as a virtue in the Old Testament and the New. To wit, the fear of the Lord is the instruction of wisdom, and before honor is humility. Proverbs 15:33. And whosoever shall exalt himself shall be abased, and he that shall humble himself shall be exalted. Matthew 23:12. Heedless of all this, rejecting all this, Cain enters into a creative union with the spirit of sin and renders himself murderously vengeful. He does so instead of changing, instead of undergoing a transformative metanoia, instead of confessing, repenting, and determining to do better, even when called out by God himself. This rejection is the very sin against the Holy Spirit that Christ defines as unforgivable, Matthew 3, 28-30. Job takes a different tack. He remains faithful, retains his belief in the essential goodness of both himself, therefore man, as well as God, even though his circumstances are such that he is pushed beyond any reasonable human limit. In consequence of his enduring upward aim and faithful conviction, all that he has lost, all that has been so unjustly taken from him, is restored and more. So the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than his beginning. For he had 14,000 sheep and 6,000 camels and 1,000 yoke of oxen and 1,000 she-asses. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. And he called the name of the first Jemima, and the name of the second Keziah, and the name of the third Keren-hapuk. And in all the land were no women found so fair as the daughters of Job, and their father gave them inheritance among their brethren. After this lived Job 140 years and saw his sons and his sons' sons, even 4 generations. So Job died, being old and full of days. Job 42, 12-17. It might well be objected, the ends do not justify the means. The fact that God raises Job to heights beyond what he had previously attained does not mean that it is somehow magically acceptable for the absolute to have killed his children, destroyed his possessions, compromised his health, and undermined his reputation. Not, at least, if we are applying human standards of evaluation. But the spirit of being and becoming itself is, and must forever remain in some important sense, beyond such standards. Not least, because we are faced with the task of reconciling ourselves to the vagaries of existence, no matter how extreme the demand. Why? At least because the alternative, paralyzing subjugation to terror, catastrophic loss of all hope, possession by rage,